Good afternoon and welcome to the UK Column viewers. I have a guest today. I think this is going to be a very interesting interview. The lady that's joining me is Nicola Lund, and she's got some very interesting information. The first bit is a personal story about what happened to her aunt in the medical system. But Nicola's also been doing a lot of investigation into what we'll call policies at this stage with the Welsh Government. So, Nicola, can I welcome you into the UK Column studio?
Thank you, Brian. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you very much. Now, I did have a little chat with you before earlier this morning where we were talking about some of the things that we may cover in this interview. And one of the things I said to you is, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself? Because you've got an interesting history. I can see at one stage you were a teacher and you've moved through to doing, well, becoming a journalist or doing some journalistic work, which is very interesting. You kindly produced an article for the UK Column back in, it was October last year. We'll come on to that one in a minute. But let's kick off. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got from school teaching to working as an investigative journalist.
I grew up in Swansea and, the Swansea and Neath area. And I had a little bit of an unconventional childhood, but I had a happy childhood. But one of the things I haven't really talked about before is the fact that I, although I had a happy childhood, I did actually grow up with a little bit with verbal and emotional abuse, and from my stepfather, actually, from the age of about 3 until I was about 17, when my mother got divorced from him. And I think it's relevant because I did go off the rails a little bit in my late teens, and I didn't actually go into full-time education until I was 21. So then I did begin a degree course in Welsh history and Welsh studies. I completed a year of that in Cardiff University, and then I discovered that I was expecting my daughter. So I kind of fell into teaching out of necessity, really. I decided that I didn't really want to be putting my daughter into holiday clubs and the like during the school holidays. So that's how I ended up teaching. And I loved the work. I loved working with children. And I did it for 10 years. But I think, obviously, if I'd had my time over again, I probably would have gone down the journalism route. So that you know, I've always been interested in writing. I was fortunate. I got frustrated with the teaching because mainly the politics and the curriculum, because whereas we were teaching to the national curriculum, which was broad enough in itself, being comprised of 10 subjects. In Wales, we had an extra subject because we had to teach Welsh language. And we all felt, you know, everybody I worked with, that the curriculum was too broad and there was not enough depth. And there was never enough time to consolidate the children's learning. Because with everything else what goes on in schools ordinarily, from assemblies, school concerts, visits to schools, there's never enough time to complete the schemes of work that you get given anyway. And I felt that the curriculum was also geared towards making everybody academic, and not all children are academic. So that I found frustrating. And I was fortunate to have an exit route, so to speak, because my father has a business. I didn't grow up with my father. I was very young when my mother and father divorced. But I've always been in contact with him. And he got to a point where he said, well, come on board, you know, come and help me with the business. And so that's what I did for 10 years. And then after I got married, I then had to move away from where the business is, from where it was feasible to travel. So I, at the same time as teaching and working for my father, I also had my aunt in the background who doesn't have children. And she's been quite, she's had a lot of mobility issues over the years. She's been housebound and what have you. So I've also been helping to look after her regularly over the years. So I then took the decision a few years ago after we moved to West Wales to do some, to go back to some supply teaching. So I did go back for a few years. But again, that was a very frustrating period because I soon realised again that there had been a lot of changes over that 10-year period that I was away from it all, including the fact that I'd expected to go back and get work as a supply directly through schools and get paid at my scale rate. But I found out that in the intervening period, all of a sudden, it was all done through agencies. And I became involved in the activism side of it. And we found out then that this was all down to Welsh Government and basically local authorities opting out of pension obligations eventually. So going back to supply teaching with the extra issues, you know, getting paid at a lower rate, terrible behaviour having gone to got worse over the years, and various other things. I then thought to myself, well, I'm going to, that's right, I had an article published about the teaching agency thing on a website called nation.cymru. So that then piqued my interest in maybe doing a journalism course. So I managed to do a diploma online. And that's where my writing started. I sort of hesitate to call myself a journalist because even though I've had quite a few things published, it's not something that I have the time, unfortunately, to devote to because I'm still looking after my aunt and she lives 90 miles away from me and I'm still helping my father and his business is another 90 or so miles away in a slightly different direction. So I've got a lot to juggle at the moment.
Thank you for giving us that. It's always nice when people tell the audience a bit about themselves because that sets the scene. And I'm smiling here slightly because I'm thinking, yeah, you've got a little bit of the rebel in you, however that came about. And it's interesting that so many people now that seem to be doing something to challenge the system, when you go back in their lives, yeah, there's just a little bit something where they've decided they're not happy with what they're seeing and they start to do things. So I'm going to put you in that category. And that's a very positive statement. And the other thing I'm going to say is, I think you should call yourself a journalist because we're here as the UK Column team. We work in media and journalism ourselves, but you've got the qualification. I'm going to say we're all self-taught. So I think you definitely should call yourself a journalist. And you've written for the Conservative Woman. You've done some articles for TCW. And I think also Sonia Poulton's had you on her show a while ago.
Yes, I think I'm up to about 16 articles on TCW now. And I think that started with the Welsh Government.
Yeah.
And the criminalising of smack parents who you know, smack their children. I'm not an advocate of smacking, but I grew up obviously having the odd smack when I was a child, and it didn't leave the scars that perhaps the verbal and emotional abuse did. I don't feel it's I feel like it's a sledgehammer to crack a nut.
I think I would agree with that. Well, we're talking about writing. Just tell us a little bit. Well, this is a little bit of reselling the article. You did an article for the UK Column called Wales, a testing ground for the well-being economy. And what made you, I think I might know, but what made you head in the direction of that? You were starting to look at policy in the Welsh Government, presumably.
Yes. To go back to your thing about being a rebel, I think, yes, I think possibly growing up with this mistrust of authority then in my family, put it that way, that has probably led me to being rather cynical and critical of governments. And it was basically the reaction to COVID that got me interested in all this Welsh government policy, because I think I was taking the Spectator magazine at the time. And initially, when they said for the over 70s to be wary and to stay at home, you know, that I didn't think much of that sort of thing. And then, but when they started talking about locking healthy people down, I remember reading an article in the Spectator about the distinction between with COVID and from COVID. I think it was written by a doctor. And it just made me think that there was something not quite right with the whole the lockdowns and this, you know, the massive of debt that we were going to get ourselves into over this. So and I had an interesting experience with my aunt. She had told me, I was visiting her every week, but she told me to stay at home. She said, "Look, I'm fine. I've got enough food." So I was in contact with her every day over the phone. But I think she was watching television constantly every day, getting herself anxious, probably not eating as well as she should have been. And she contacted me, one day to say that she'd stayed in bed, that she wasn't feeling great. And I said to her, "Look, I'm coming up in a few days. You know, I said I'm allowed to travel and to come and see you." And that same day that I got up to go to visit, I received a text at about 6:30 in the morning saying, "I'm on the floor." And she was, at the time, she was 88. So I called for an ambulance and I met a first responder at her home. And she was on the landing, just sitting up. They put a mask on her for, you know, just in case. But she didn't have any symptoms. She was just a bit under par. And the first responder actually said to me that all her obs are fine, but he said she can't support her weight on her walking frame because she was using a walking frame. So he said, "I'd like her to go in for rehabilitation more than anything." So she was reluctant. We persuaded her. I can remember saying to her, "Look, it's only going to be a few days. They'll be kicking you out for the COVID patients." And she'd been on her own, just to add, this is relevant. She'd been on her own for about 12 or 13 days prior to that. She had had a cleaner going in, but the cleaner had stopped coming, and I've verified this on the text messages and everything. So off she went into the ambulance. I wasn't allowed, obviously, to go with her. And I can remember on the way home receiving a phone call. This was a few hours later, from the consultant, who said basically that, there were no issues with her health. He just said her kidney function's below par. And he said that she'd swabbed negative, but he was going to run a test just to rule out the virus, and that she'd agreed to a DNR. And I didn't really think anything more of this because I wasn't really sure what a DNR was, but that was it. And then that was that. So about 24 hours later, I rang for an update, and then they told me that she'd tested positive and that she'd been sent to the COVID ward. So she was in for about 8 weeks in total, but they'd admitted her to Llandoch Hospital, which is in Penarth, just outside Cardiff. She was in that hospital for a few weeks. At no time did I ever get any calls saying that her situation had deteriorated or anything like this. She was then transferred to the Dragon Heart Hospital, which was the only field hospital to have been utilised in Wales. And she came out of there actually saying to me that she said, I saw hundreds of empty beds in there. I think they're exaggerating it. But then she sort of flip-flopped over the weeks and months that were, because she would be watching television, she'd be watching Jeremy Vine and Hillary Jones, and she wasn't sure what to make of the whole COVID thing. But I said to her about the DNR, and I said, did you agree? I'd forgotten about it until she came out. I said, do you remember agreeing to having a DNR? And she was absolutely adamant that she hadn't. And she's very, although she was 88 at the time, she and she's 91 now, and she's still just as sharp. She said, no, I did not. So we got her medical notes. We requested them. And I was also curious to know about whether there was anything in there to do with the PCR test, because I'd, you know, heard about the incidence of false positives, etc., but there wasn't. But what we did find, to our surprise, was that it's, you know, they didn't seem to know whether it was COVID or bacterial pneumonia. That was one thing. And the clinical notes are quite interesting as well, because 4 days after being admitted, I've got it written here, they've actually put down in the clinical notes, frustrated that she cannot work out where she will have caught COVID, feels well. And in actual fact, I've asked her recently, because I've gotten about it over the last few years, but when there was the ITV documentary recently, not a documentary, the drama recently called Breathless, I actually asked her, I said, look, I've never asked you about this before, but when you were in the COVID ward, you know, what was it like? And she said, well, I didn't know I was in a COVID ward. I said, yes, they told me they'd put you in a COVID ward. And I said, was it full of people? You know, were these people, did you see people on ventilators, or did you see people gasping or coughing? And she actually laughed and said, no. We'd put the medical notes to one side after looking through them initially. And it wasn't until a couple of months later that I'd heard about the midazolam issue, the fact that some people were believing that their loved ones had been killed through co-prescribing of midazolam and morphine. So that I went back to look at her notes just out of curiosity, and there they were in the list, in the PRN, the list, the ProRenata, the list of anticipatory meds. And I called up an acquaintance, friend of a friend who was working as a theatre nurse during COVID, because I wanted to know exactly what this PRN meant and the amounts and the dates and things like that. And then she told me that if there are dates at the side of it, that means that the drugs have been administered. So we learned then that she obviously hadn't been given midazolam, thank goodness, but she'd been given morphine. And she said, well, I'm allergic to morphine, I shouldn't have had it. So we took it up with the health board and we began asking questions. And as it happened, it took a long time really to get any answers. First of all, I wasn't getting any response, so I was resending emails. And eventually they said that, oh, no, we didn't know that your aunt was allergic to morphine. And then I had to refer them back to the triage notes where it actually states allergies, morphine. So obviously she hadn't had an adverse reaction at the time, but they did then say, well, you know, we're going to offer a payment of £250, which, you know, that's not why we were asking questions, but obviously they gave her this payment. And I kept on to them asking again, well, can you explain more why she had this list of medications in her notes? And they were talking about other medications. They were never referring to midazolam. So I got the ombudsman involved in the end, and the ombudsman said that, yes, they agreed that they weren't being straight with us and that they would need to give us a more definitive response. And eventually they did actually say that it was there so that it would have been to make her comfortable should her condition have deteriorated. But to go back to the lady I spoke to over the phone, the theatre nurse, I also want to mention as well, I've got it written down here, because I don't want to get it misquote, but she actually said to me, she worked in ICU and in theatres during 2020, and she said, recommendations were given that would probably shock the majority of the population. And she said, and I said to her, well, you know, are you aware that the MHRA guidance is that benzodiazepines and opioids are not meant to be co-prescribed, especially for people who are over 60? And she said that the reality is far from the guidance. And she told me that rules were flexed during COVID and that decisions were made on the basis of life years. And consultants made decisions regarding DNRs and dignified deaths. And she was fully aware of the blanket DNRs given in nursing home settings.
Just to bring them on screen, if you're happy, because you did provide just two excerpts from the medical documents. This one here on screen, which is talking about worsening inflammatory markers. And it's question mark progression of COVID and question mark consolidation consistent with bacterial pneumonia. So at one stage, those documents seemed to indicate that they were suspicious of her health. Do you want to add something more to that?
They did say that she had a bit of a cough when she'd been admitted, when she was in the assessment centre. So I don't know whether she had picked anything up or what, but you know, she's definitely when she left me, the first responder had said all her obs are fine.
But I notice on this form, it also talks about midazolam as well. So just for clarity, she did get both at some stage. Is that right?
No, she wasn't. If she'd been given midazolam, there would have been a date at the side, you know, of where it's written on the form. But she was just given morphine.
On the form, you talked about the date, and it's got 11th of the 4th, midazolam. So it has got a date to the left of it.
Yeah, the date on the left is the date that they put it in the list of anticipatory meds. The date that I meant to, that I was referring to, is the date on the right-hand side. And that shows when it was administered. And the interesting thing about the 11th of April, they put this, what I believe to be an end-of-life pathway, in her notes on the 11th of April. And they obviously told me at a later date that it was there just in case, you know, her condition had deteriorated and she wouldn't have made a recovery. But if you look at the, when I looked at the clinical notes for that same day, it actually said patient is sitting up in bed and doesn't necessarily feel any worse. So she wasn't even poorly on that particular day that these meds were put in there into her just in case list of meds.
You pressed a complaint through. You obviously spoke to the hospital, but you end up with the ombudsman. And what was the specific complaint? That she had been administered morphine when she shouldn't have been?
Yes, we also wanted answers as to why midazolam was there, contrary to MHRA guidelines. That was the main thrust of the complaint.
So how did the hospital respond to that?
It was the health board rather than the hospital that responded. And they, like I said, there was a bit of obfuscation, and they kept going on about some of the other medications that she was on at first. And I had to keep going back to them and saying, no, I'm not asking about those. I'm asking about these specific ones, the benzodiazepine and the opioids. And that was when, obviously, I got the ombudsman to intervene.
Right, okay.
And I wasn't getting straight answers.
Okay, and what was the outcome from the ombudsman then?
The ombudsman gave the health board about a month, I think it was, to respond. And they eventually did, and they... What they had said was that they admitted, really, in a roundabout way, that they were end-of-life medications that would have assured her comfort if she were, you know, wasn't going to survive from COVID.
Right. The whole thing, I'm going to use the word scary because I do find it scary because it's so grey. You've just quoted the health official that sort of said to you that rules were bent during that period. And then at the same time, do not resuscitate appears out of nowhere. And also, potentially, they were administering combinations of medication which are known to be lethal. It's as though common sense has gone out of the NHS system.
Yes, and it left her with a big fear of, well, that's right. I wrote about the DNR as well. That was one of the things I wrote about on TCW because that was another thing she said, well, I didn't agree to that and I'm not having that, you know, and we asked them if they could remove that from her medical records. But it turns out that it's illegal because your medical records are deemed to be legal documents that you can't actually have a DNR removed, but you can ask for it to be reviewed on future admission to hospital. And the funny thing is she did go in again then last year. Now, again, that was a mobility issue. She had become bedridden and so she went in it was June last year, and once again she'd gone in with no symptoms and she was labelled as a COVID patient again. She tested positive.
Right.
And of course we had the conversation about the DNR. That was one of the first things because I'm her next of kin, that was the first thing that the doctor wanted to talk to me about. And I said, look, you know, we this isn't right. We don't want her to have this DNR. But he basically said that it's very, very difficult to get a DNR, you know, to go from having a DNR in place to no DNR. And I didn't want to labour the point at the time because we were having the conversation in front of my aunt, and I didn't want to upset her any more than she already was upset about just being in hospital.
I've learnt something straight away there because I've never heard before that DNRs are difficult, impossible to get removed. So she doesn't agree to it in the first place. I suspect she doesn't know anything about that DNR on her medical records. And then when you say this is there without the patient approving it, they say, oh, well, yes. And by the way, it's nearly impossible to get it off your records. This is incredible, if I follow it through in a logical way.
It is. And I think that the fact that families weren't allowed into hospital during 2020 didn't help, because I think the situation is that you normally do involve the patient and the family in such a decision. But... you know, dare I say it, I think they've probably bent the truth a little bit there in saying that she agreed to it. And of course, if there's nobody there to witness that, then it's her word against theirs. I did in fact ask if they record these conversations, because I knew what I'd heard over the phone. You know, I said, do you record these conversations? And they don't.
And then at some time after that, you also challenged over you challenged Public Health Wales over their warnings to do with vaccines, and you actually won, or you got a Pyrrhic victory on that.
Yeah, that was just a small challenge, really. I was looking at their website. We had lost a family friend, basically, who had been vaccinated, and he was only 62, and he'd gone into hospital, and he died. He was put on a ventilator, and he was labelled a COVID death. And when I saw that the Public Health was saying on their website, I think this was sometime in 2021, that the vaccine will prevent hospitalisation and death, I obviously wrote to them and challenged them. And I said, well, this isn't what happened in our friend's case. And to my surprise, they did actually reply, and they did say, we take on board your comments and we will revisit our wording. And I think then they changed it.
The response was changed. So they say to the frequently answered question now reads, like all medicines, no vaccine is 100% effective. Some people may still get COVID-19 despite having a vaccination, but this should be less severe. So your challenging produced a change in what they had to say.
Yes, so that was a small victory. And I also challenged Welsh Blood regarding the mask policy as well for blood donors.
Right.
This was, I'd been following Peter Hitchens and his, because I was a blood donor for years, I noticed that Peter Hitchens had started, he'd travelled into Wales on a number of occasions because the mask mandates were brought into England sooner than they were brought into Wales. And when they eventually came in September of 2020 in Wales, I'd gone to make an appointment to donate blood, but I was told that I'd have to wear a mask. And I'd already contacted my GP because I do have a genuine fear stemming from childhood trauma of anything covering my face. And so he'd said, well, I can't exempt you, but I can write you a letter of support. So I'd gone back to Welsh Blood and I said, look, well, I've got a letter from my GP. And I think you'll find that you can't exempt, you can't stop me from coming to give blood without wearing a mask because this is a contravention of the Equality Act 2010. And it took about 8 weeks. They wrote back to me and they said, look, sorry, we need more time. And they eventually got back to me, I think it was early December, and they said, they apologised and they said, yes, they had to seek external legal advice, and they admitted then that they would have to realign their service with the requirements of the Equality Act. Although I didn't actually get around to donating blood that on that particular time, because they then, a couple of days before Christmas 2020, they then wrote back to say, sorry, we've had to reverse our decision temporarily because of new variants. But it was, another small victory. And it was something that got me in contact with Peter Hitchens at the time, because I felt he would be interested in this, and something else I wrote about for TCW. And, right. And of course, Peter Hitchens had shared it. And, that was quite a compliment, really.
No, it's very good. And just a little question, but as you're doing all this, you're challenging the hospital, you're challenging the local health authority. Were you doing all this on your own, or did you have friends or family who were supporting you?
No, I was really doing it all on my own. My husband's obviously been supportive through this all, but no, this was, a single-handed thing.
Yeah, and that's pretty difficult. I know from a family incident myself, when you come to challenge the NHS, it's hard work and it can be quite challenging. I think that's the word that's used these days. But yeah, so you did it on your own. Well done, Nicola, because you did get a result out of it. And probably the best part of the story is your aunt came out. And so many other people didn't come out of the system after those sorts of things happened to them.
Yes, and one thing I don't know if I mentioned, but there were only about 46 people ever in that Dragon Heart hospital that my aunt was in. And when she came out, they were virtually closing it down. And I think this was about early June time in 2020. But she told me that another lady that had come out the same time as her was 99. Mm. So there was an 88-year-old and a 99-year-old at the time coming out of there. And yet this wasn't even mentioned in the news. All they were doing was giving us the daily death counts and the doom and gloom. They weren't telling us that people of that age were even surviving it.
So two lucky ladies in that case then, which is good. Okay, well, that leads us on to the fact that obviously you're still at work challenging the system about what it's doing, and you sent me some very interesting material to do with policy in Wales, and most of this stems to, I think we'll call it Agenda 2030, but there's a number of different parts of it. Now, I've taken some of the documents that you provided. This one, of course, very striking with the red dragon. It's the rising to the triple challenge of Brexit, COVID-19 and climate change for health, well-being and equality in Wales. Now, I had to smile when I saw the well-being because that ties in with your article that you'd written for the column a while ago. But you'd particularly flagged up the 20-minute neighbourhoods and comments to do with transport and what they called active travel. And I'll just bring the next one up on screen and then I'll let you comment. This was one of the pages of the route map, a strategic framework for change. We'll see here that you'd highlighted this comment: staff and citizens demand zero tolerance of unsustainable behaviour as it's socially unacceptable. Now, that staff might relate to NHS or teaching.
This is, I think, aimed at all public sector staff, really. So, what I need to mention as well at this point is the publication that you just put up regarding the triple challenge. That's actually a publication from a collaboration between Public Health Wales and the World Health Organization. Back in 2018, I discovered that, well, I didn't discover it back in 2018. I discovered in 2020 when I started researching that that Public Health Wales was the only health service in the UK which had a collaboration with the World Health Organization, and it's called the International Health Coordination Centre, and it's the first of its kind in the world. Apparently there are other, you know, similar little collaborations going on.
That's actually quite a statement though, isn't it, that zero tolerance of unsustainable behavior as it is socially unacceptable. This is a very controlling statement, and that obviously jumped off the page to you because you put your big red pen around it.
Yes, indeed. And an interesting thing as well is that the IHCC have got, they established a behavioural science unit in May of 2022. Mm. And again, that's all to do with getting people to think in the right way, basically, about the climate and about the Team Wales approach that we're supposed to be going to be encouraged to take. You know, they've said that they want everybody to embed the climate in the way that we work, travel, and play. You know, it's going to be all encompassing. We were also the first country in the world to declare a climate emergency as well,
right?
In 2019.
Yeah, I think this is the hive mind is where it's taking to people. It's saying through the applied behavioral psychology that we all have to think the same way. We have to be on board the same policies. That's how I take these documents.
Definitely, yes.
Another comment that you picked up in one of them was the 20-minute neighbourhood. So we're seeing very strongly that if we're talking about anything to do with transport policies, what's actually there at the background is 20-minute neighbourhoods or 15-minute cities. That's clearly what's been talked about. But if we pop on one more, this one I found quite interesting, and it was the title of this document that caught my eye: International Horizon Scanning and Learning to Inform. Wales COVID-19 Public Health Response and Recovery. Now, I started to see documents about horizon scanning way back, I'm going to say maybe 15 years ago, and I was seeing those to do with the European Union. But I found it very cold language. It was all like a laboratory experiment going on. That's how I saw longitudinal studies was another expression that they used. And here's horizon scanning. But in this one, you had picked out that schools, formal teaching would disappear altogether due to rapid advancements in artificial intelligence, virtual and augmented reality, and I think this is very significant, it says, and the Internet of Things. So this is very, very deep change policy that you're witnessing there. Schools in their present form are to be no more in the future.
Yes, well, what got me into all this was I began seeing that the containment policies, as they were called, the lockdowns, the way they were being reported on the BBC and on Sky News, it was all very convenient. It was they were saying, well, how wonderful this is, really, because you know we're having animals are roaming again, and the planet is you know. This is going to be much better for the planet. And I thought this is all this is feeding in nicely to the net zero talk. And so of course that got me looking into these policies. I had an article published then on TCW and it was called Wales in a Very Convenient Pandemic. And basically, I tried to highlight the fact that there were certain, that the lockdowns in Wales were sort of some of the so-called remedies and were conducive to plans that had already been put in place prior to 2020. You know, I went back and I looked at the Public Health Wales 10-year health strategy, and that was quite revealing. You know, and they were starting to talk about planetary health, so that you know everything is interrelated: animal health, human health, planetary health is all interrelated. And it was the horizon scanning. I think there was a monthly publication going out on this IHCC, the International Health Coordination Centre, and they were talking about, they were looking at aspects of the lockdowns around the world and how, and you know, what was happening in various countries. And and then I saw that about the schools and I thought, well, they were already planning for, in Wales, for around 30% of public sector workers to work remotely because of the environment. For example, they were saying that the NHS, being the largest carbon emitter, the public sector carbon emitter, you know, they were looking for feasibility studies to be done for up to 30% of NHS to work remotely. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. When you look at the fact that the face-to-face GP appointments had disappeared for a while, and to a large extent are still not back to normal. So, yeah, I had that article published. And interestingly, a number of the links in the article have now broken. They've been changed. The Public Health Wales, you know, I don't know whether that's a coincidence or what.
It's not a coincidence, Nicola. This happens too yeah. often. If we go back through some of the archived or older documents on UK Column, the links have disappeared. It is a big problem, because linking in articles makes them very relevant and easy to read at the time. But clearly, local authorities and the government are going back and removing documents and statements from the internet. There's no question that that's happening. Can I just because I got it on screen and I'm really fascinated about this one, you'd also picked up on this particular page, which called itself Spotlight Example on Transport and Active Travel. And then the first sentence here says, during the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was little to no travelling permitted in Wales as the population was required to stay at home unless it was for an essential journey. And it goes on and then it says, the pandemic provides an opportunity to reflect and refocus on reducing people's carbon footprints and have co-benefits to health and the economy. And again, this to me was very much like we're lab rats, and these people weren't feeling sympathy or empathy for the population during COVID. COVID was simply something that happened where they were able to monitor a number of changes. And they're now putting it in documents saying, oh, well, as a result of this happening during lockdown, we can now see how we can change travel. We can change people's working habits in order to make what a utopia for the future. It's just as though we are the lab rats. That's the feeling I get when I read the documents.
Absolutely, yes. I always felt, to me, it always felt like a mass social experiment. And, you know, we even had the deputy minister at the time in Wales and chief whip, Jane Hutt. She was saying, well, just 4 weeks into lockdown, that we cannot go back to business as normal. And of course, then we also had Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland advocating. She was advocating for a well-being economy just a couple of weeks prior to the pandemic response. And the more I look through the documents, the policy documents, you know, for example, I got one written here, a quote written here from a document called Beyond Recycling. And it says, we already have a strong foundation for a circular economy in Wales. This was demonstrated by how our communities responded to the pandemic, coming together to collaborate, act and share resources. We reconnected with our local areas, walking and appreciating our green spaces and nature as many of us walked from home. We shopped and used local businesses and sourced local products. We made more of the resources we had, and we shared and swapped locally the things we no longer needed. We used our vehicles a lot less. And you know, you can just tell reading some of that, it's nonsense, really. I mean, we didn't shop and use our local businesses because a lot of them weren't allowed to open.
Just push back a little bit on one thing that you say it's nonsense, and I completely understand why. But of course, it's very serious nonsense, because at the end of the day, these nonsensical policies are being used to change our lives. So, you know, we can call it nonsense, but actually the effects of it are very serious. And the average person simply has no idea what's actually coming. The person on the street in Wales or England has no idea that their local authorities are following through on these policies.
Yes, absolutely. And then this is why I started a Substack then, to focus on the Welsh policies that are online. I'm trying desperately to get people to see what's coming and to consider, you know, what's being said in these policy documents. But
Are you getting a response to what you've been writing and talking about? Do you see people responding?
Well, yes, I've got a few hundred followers, and I'm getting, you know, positive feedback. I haven't had anybody sort of contradict anything I've said, but it's quite frustrating, the lack of awareness in, I don't know if it's the same everywhere, but particularly in Wales.
It is the same everywhere. Yeah, there's no question of this. Let's push on through, because we've got a couple more to show the audience. But you'd also picked up on this document, net zero carbon status by 2030. Net zero carbon status by 2030, a route map for decarbonisation across the Welsh public sector. So this is another one of these policies which is, we'll say, come out of nowhere, as far as most people are concerned, but it's talking about a radical change of the whole of the public sector in Wales. No public debate, presumably, I would suspect little public debate in the Welsh government. It's simply a policy which is now creeping out through the local authorities and being enacted.
Yes, and it's just mind-boggling. I mean, I've only just started to scratch the surface, really, but when you see the amount of publications, the amount of consultations, the amount of surveys that have been going on in the last 10 years specifically, it's just mind-boggling, you know? You know, we've got think tanks, we've got community interest companies coming out with things, we've got social purpose companies, and they seem to want to be wanting to micromanage every single aspect of our lives, from health to, you know, travel, homes. They want us to decarbonize our homes by 2050. This is coming.
Ideal prompt there to come up with the Carbon Trust. So this is NHS Wales Decarbonisation Strategic Delivery Plan. It says about the Carbon Trust, established in 2001, working with businesses, governments and institutions around the world, helping them contribute to and benefit from a more sustainable future through carbon reduction. They do give the names of the people involved, but what you see is a partnership between the Welsh Government and the public sector and the Carbon Trust. But, you know, what do we really know about them? You know, how did they get in their positions of authority in the first place? I've looked at the Carbon Trust before, and you say it's like they suddenly appeared out of nowhere. And then they are in advising governments, not only in UK, Wales, UK, but also around the world.
Yes, and it's all being done very quietly. You know, everything is done very surreptitiously. You know, we don't get a say in anything. Some of the consultations, for example, we're actually committed in through a piece of legislation called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act to sustainable development. This act was passed in 2015, the same year as the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals came into being, coincidentally. It's said to be an exemplar of innovation on governance for sustainable development. And apparently there had been a national conversation which took place in 2014, the year before this. But this national consultation only involved 6,474 people. It was called The Wales We Want. And amazingly, the general public who participated in this, and I've not met anybody that did, they put climate change as the top priority above education, employment, housing, health, crime and violence. You know, it's just astounding.
It is astounding. It's astounding how policy can come in external to government, because this is not in the first instant policy that's come from national governments. This has come from international bodies such as the World Health Organization or the UN itself, or the World Economic Forum. It's those sorts of global bodies which are making this policy. And yet we're now living in a world where we're seeing it enacted right down at local authority level. It's quite incredible the speed that it's come in and the depth. And just because I can see it queued up on screen, smart cities, of course, and smart working is a big part of the future that they envisage. And this one says that smart working will never be able to replace the majority of NHS Wales frontline services. Nevertheless, the following initiatives and key actions are set out to ensure that the advantages of smart working can be incorporated into the day-to-day running of NHS Wales where feasible. Now, if we just expand that, because you'd used your highlighting pen again, it says, increasing the community outreach by providing health and social care from hub locations closer to home. And what they're doing is looking at the proportion of the workforce that could feasibly work remotely, and to actively encourage staff to work remotely where this can be feasibly achieved. But they recognise that in some parts of rural Wales, this will not be possible without infrastructure upgrades. So we can't provide medical care for people at present. I think that's a true statement. The NHS is struggling to provide medical care at the moment. But not to worry, if we get people working remotely, if we get more people working from home, the standard of medical care and treatment is going to be better. I'm going to use your words. This has got to be nonsense.
Yes, definitely. And I was just looking for, I'd written some notes on the collaboration World Health Organization. You know, it's meant to be sharing expertise globally, and it's all going to be for the benefit of the health of the people of Wales eventually. And yet, at the moment, I think, well, we've probably got possibly the worst health service in the whole of the United Kingdom.
Well, certainly Debbie Evans would say, if she was here with us today, we actually don't have a medical healthcare system operating in this country anymore. She's very happy to say, if you analyse what's there and how appallingly it works, and we can say with no disrespect to many of the staff who are doing their best in the increasing chaos, but Debbie would say, you look at it, we really haven't got a healthcare system, but we have all this planning for the future. So Future Wales, that's a good topic. You've got a national plan 2040, and all of this one seems to be based around climate change. Is that about right?
Yes, I would say so. And again, I that was another publication that I based one of my TCW articles on. It's a very lengthy publication, and yes, as the graphic which I've highlighted illustrates, it says it's based upon a 50th percentile projection, which means that outcomes are as likely as unlikely to happen. And you think, what does all this come? You know, well, what does this actually mean?
Let's help the viewers out a bit and just read a few of the things, because it's got projections as a result of climate change for Wales for 2050 in the first column and 2080 in the second column. So it's saying summer average temperatures in Wales are going to increase by 1.34 degrees C 2050 and 3.03 degrees C in 2080. And the one I noticed particularly, because it's been a bit gloomy and rainy here, is summer precipitation in Wales is projected to decrease by 16% in 2050. And in 2080, summer precipitation in Wales is going to decrease by 23%. And if we ask, where is the evidence to support these figures? I'm going to guess, I haven't been able to go all the way through the document, but I'm going to guess there's not a lot of factual evidence to support those claims.
Yes, exactly. And one of the interesting things in that Future Wales document was the fact that they want to increase the population density in urban areas as well. I think it's something like they want to increase it to 50 dwellings per hectare. It doesn't actually, from memory, it doesn't actually say why. But that, you know, I know that, for example, where I live in Pembrokeshire, that people are asking questions about the Freeport, and a friend of mine hasn't been able to get an actual a definitive boundary of this Freeport and the implications. And you know, people are wondering, will they be looking to move people out of this Freeport boundary for any reason? You know, and are they looking to have get people moving away from coastal areas. But it's all very, it's all very
uncertain.
Confusing.
It's uncertain,
that's the word, yeah.
Yeah. And Nicola, what about the politicians themselves in Wales? Are there any of them that you can say are showing signs of challenging what's happening? Or are they all conforming with the policy through their party structure?
To be perfectly honest, I don't take an awful lot of notice of what's going on in the Senedd. It's a lot of pantomime, a lot of posturing, a lot of virtue signalling. I've taken more an interest in the actual policy. That's what worries me. You know, I've been in contact with my local member of the Senedd, and he's been polite and quite helpful, but he's in the, you know, he's a conservative. I don't really think there's any viable opposition in Wales, and the way that they're talking about expanding the Senedd to increase the number of Senedd members, the way it's looking is that we'll never ever have a change of government. We'll be stuck with a Labour, Welsh Labour or Labour implied coalition forevermore.
Unless people get out there and really push to change that system. And this is where it's a little bit sad, because people can do a lot if enough people actually stand up to say, no, we're not having this, because they could, of course, put up independent councillors, independent candidates.
Yes, I just feel that... I just feel that there is an awful lot of apathy in Wales, and a lot of people vote Labour because, I mean, I'm politically homeless, by the way, I'll just state that now, but I'm not just anti-Labour, but so too many people vote Labour because their parents did, their fathers and their grandfathers. And
yeah. Yes, this is true. I just wanted to say that I got an email this morning from a lady in Australia. And when I read it through, I thought, well, this is really interesting. I'll add it to the end of your interview today. And if we pop that up on screen, the text is a bit small, so I'll keep it very simple. But this is Mara, who's in New South Wales. And she's put forward... it's either an email or a letter, but it says, recently I spoke for less than 5 minutes at the public forum, Midwestern Regional Council, MRGI, if I pronounce that properly. I think this is New South Wales. Goes on to say, the verbal presentation was not recorded by Midwestern Regional Council, to my knowledge, although I note that other councils such as Melbourne, include the public forum in the records of the council for public viewing. There is a sign in the council chambers indicating that recordings of public meetings are prohibited. So what this tells me is there's a challenge going on to the local council. And where I'm coming to is that it goes on to talk about the climate change agenda. And this sentence says, it all seems to revolve around the dreaded climate change agenda. The New South Wales government will be releasing that document in 2024. It's not available yet. And the reason I'm talking about this email is that you are there in Wales and you're talking about a Welsh government policy documents driven by climate change. And here we've got a person in Wales, in New South Wales, Australia, also talking about exactly the same sort of documents which are driving matters to do with climate change. And later it goes on to talk about smart meters, smart surveillance, etc. So it's very clear that the policies that you've discovered at work in South Wales, in the UK, and what we've got happening on the other side of the globe, they are so alike that this has got to be a common global agenda that we're now experiencing at local level.
Definitely, yeah. And I feel like the global answer to COVID, the lockdowns were a sort of dry run for the
changes.
You know, the solutions to the climate agenda.
Yes.
The so-called solutions.
Yeah. Nicola, thank you very much. It's been really interesting going through this. There's a lot more to be talked about here. But in the first instance, I want to just thank you for having the courage to stand up and challenge the NHS over your aunt, because I know that does take courage to do that. And then you've had enough fire in you to get on and really start looking at these policy documents. I often ask this question, and I need to do it with you, but what would you like the UK column audience to do? How can they stand up against this? What would you like to see them do? How can they help you?
Well, if there's anybody, I'm sure there are plenty of people listening in Wales. I would be grateful if they would just take a look at my TCW articles on Wales and my Substack page on Wales, and just read and digest and share as much as they can. I know that our elected representatives are not very effective, unfortunately. You know, we've started challenging our local council members. I've got a couple of friends, Helen and Sharon, who I know have been in contact with your programme. They've been putting in freedom of information requests and challenging councillors, but unfortunately, it appears that even in our local council, we've got council members who blindly voted for a climate emergency a couple of years ago and are now regretting it. But we just need to, you know, I've been challenging my councillor, and he's coming back to me saying, oh yes, I wouldn't be happy if council tax was going to be aligned to how carbon efficient our homes are in the future. But this is, you know, this is what has been recommended, and yet these local councillors have no knowledge of these things, you know.
Right.
So I would just urge people to look into who's on their council and contact them. And for what it's worth, it may not achieve anything, but it's better to have tried and failed than not to have tried at all.
And what about people challenging the council? You've done it, but do you have anything equivalent to Council Watch that seems to be growing in various areas around the country, where people are going into the council meetings and putting evidence on the table to challenge some of these policies? Do you have an equivalent of Council Watch running at all in your area or in Wales that you know about?
No, not that I know about. And I mean, as I said, there's a few of us who've started to challenge our local council, but we're trying to sort of find more information about how the whole thing, how the whole system works and what we can attend. Because I have been following some of the other people in other parts of the country, and it's great to see them going in and actually showing the evidence. But I've been in contact with one councillor who I know is sceptical, and we've asked him to meet up with us, but he's not really forthcoming. You know, he's on the one hand, he's saying yes, he thinks it's nonsense, but on the other hand, he seems a bit reluctant to actually meet with us and to share a little bit of inside knowledge about the best way to challenge.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And but as you've just said, we need people to do something. So at least you can say you stood up and fought the system. Okay. Nicola, I'm going to say thank you very much for joining me today and taking us through that. In my mind, I think we need to do a little bit more work to see whether we can help the people who are getting involved with their councils to be together and sharing information and a little bit of know-how. We've talked to some of the people involved in Council Watch to say, maybe we should get you together to talk about what you see and how you're doing things. And if we were able to do that, I'd love to give you an invite to put your penny worth in as to what's possible and maybe not possible in Wales. But I think this would be very interesting. Okay, well, thank you very much. And what's planned for the rest of the afternoon? Walking the dogs?
Yes, I think I will go out and stretch my legs now after that.
And get some fresh air.
Feed up all morning in anticipation of this chat. So, yeah.
go and de-stress with the two French bulldogs. And I very much hope you'll come and join us again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brian. Okay. Lovely to chat with you.
Bye-bye.